Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, despite the impact it would have on millions of people and the planet, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, like all such agreements, was being negotiated in secret. That is, until Greenpeace Netherlands released classified documents revealing elements of the deal the EU and the US were moving merrily toward. Now, some say the pact may be scuttled. What is in those documents? We'll hear from Karen Hansen-Kuhn of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Also on the show, what was called possibly the biggest gang raid in New York history, with involvement by Homeland Security, the FBI, and the BATF, drove similarly sweeping media coverage. A Daily News headline was typical, describing those arrested as Bronx gang members responsible for 9 years of murders and drug dealing. No allegedly, no police say, and no time really to hear from the community that was set upon in the pre-dawn by agents in military gear with helicopters overhead. Josmar Trujillo is a writer and organizer. He addresses the idea of police raids as a response to violence and why corporate media are so drawn to it. We'll hear from him on that. All of that's coming up, and there's a lot of it, so we'll take a very brief look back at recent press. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank said he would eat the page on which his column was printed if Donald Trump gained the Republican nomination. The entire commentariat is going to feel a little silly when Marco Rubio wins every Republican primary, tweeted the New York Times' Ross Douthat. Trump will still lose. Here's how, said Bloomberg News. No, Donald Trump won't win, lectured David Brooks, and on and on. These experts, it would seem, were wrong, and confidently, arrogantly, condescendingly so. But as Zaid Jilani and Glenn Greenwald, who corralled some examples for The Intercept, note, they will pay absolutely no price for it, and that's a problem. It isn't that journalists should never make predictions or that they're expected to always be right, but you do have to wonder why so much energy is devoted to the endeavor, given that nothing seems to be learned when pundits are off base. At the very least, write Greenwald and Jilani, when a profession that touts its expertise collectively is this wildly wrong about something so significant, more needs to be done than a cursory, superficial acknowledgement of error or casting blame on others before quickly moving on in the hope that it's all forgotten. Well, economist Dean Baker held up the New York Times' Thomas Friedman's May 3rd column as emblematic of this sort of establishment thinking that, as they say, might be wrong but is never in doubt. The piece has a hefty admixture of Friedman speak. On the eve of Obama's presidency, a lot of things started to get very fast all at once, he says. So that was the time to double down on our formula for success. And then there's something about sowing seeds for the next generation of startups. But in among that is a familiar complaint about how the two parties need to compromise, like the grand bargain on the budget that Obama tried to negotiate in 2011 with then-Speaker John Boehner. Friedman blames GOP stubbornness and says that Donald Trump is where this sort of extremism leads. He hopes that now everyone will move to the center and work out the deals that he'd like to see, and maybe more important, that all the know-nothings would be chased out of political debate. Speaking of the 2008 economic collapse, Friedman writes, quote, "In this vortex, a lot of the public got unmoored and disoriented, opening the way for populists with simple answers. Get rid of immigrants, end trade with China, or eliminate big banks, and all will be fine. It's nonsense." Close quote. It is nonsense. It's also not what anybody is saying. Even Trump's nutty, inhumane plan isn't to get rid of all immigrants. No one suggests ending trade with China. And while Sanders agrees with many leading economists that breaking up too-big-to-fail banks is important, none of them say that will make everything fine. Those are made-up positions that Friedman attributes to people he doesn't like as a reason to demand that all serious talk be left to serious people, like himself. Of course, those were some of the same serious people who said Donald Trump would never be the Republican nominee. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Corporate media talk about trade pacts, which have little to do at this point with actual trade, but the coverage is generally pretty thin and vague, perhaps in part because for corporate media, corporate globalization is simply inevitable. If the horse trading of livelihoods and lives for markets is unseemly, well, let's not try to take too close a look. The leak of a draft of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, by Greenpeace Netherlands may have thrown a wrench in that deal's inevitability, though media's interpretation of the document's meaning will play a role there. So what's in and what's not in the TTIP, according to these revelations? We're joined now by Karen Hansen-Kuhn, Director of Trade, Technology, and Global Governance at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Karen Hansen-Kuhn.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, I think Americans can be forgiven for not being up on another massive deal that will affect our lives, especially when pains are being taken to keep us from knowing about it, really. So what do we learn from these documents that Greenpeace Netherlands received from an unknown source and have now released?
Well, it was a big release. They released something like 200 pages of what's called consolidated text. So that shows both the U.S. position, the EU position, and areas where they've agreed on a number of chapters. It doesn't include everything, but it includes a lot of the issues that we're looking at. And what's significant about the leak, in part, is, I mean, this sounds crazy, but this is the first time we actually know what the U.S. wants out of this deal. There's been a steady flow of leaks from the European Union. They have actually published a lot of their position papers, and the U.S. has not. So a lot of the analysis we've been doing up to now has been based on what Europe said they want out of this agreement, and for the first time we're getting more evidence of what the U.S. is pushing for.
And what is the U.S. pushing for?
Well, it's funny. One of the issues we've been focusing on is around agricultural exports to Europe. You know, as you said in the intro, tariffs are already pretty low. A lot of this isn't really even about trade. It's about rules. It's about changing regulations on both sides of the Atlantic so corporations can buy and sell wherever they want. And so one of the big agenda items for the U.S. is to be able to export GMOs and other biotechnology products to Europe. There's also a big push to allow for beef produced with hormones, chicken rinsed in chlorine, practices that aren't allowed in Europe. In the chapter on food safety, what they call sanitary and phytosanitary standards, there is information about speeding up, or proposals about speeding up the approval process in Europe, about using science that is the same language they've used in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, science that is, in many cases, data provided by industry to justify new rules. So we have the U.S. asking Europe to give up a lot on their food safety standards, their agricultural standards. Europe is asking the U.S. to give up a lot on public procurement. So that's different kinds of projects that are contracted out, publicly funded programs like farm-to-school programs, highway construction. Europe would like their companies to be able to bid on any of those contracts with no buy local provisions, no minority or small business set-asides. Also, Europe wants to free up exports of liquefied natural gas, which could mean more fracking in the U.S. But I do want to say I think it would be a mistake to think that that's the whole story. Both sides are pushing really hard for new protections for investment. There's been a lot of discussion lately about this investor-state dispute settlement provision.
Right.
So that allows companies to sue governments over rules that affect their profits. So we have TransCanada suing the U.S. over the Keystone Pipeline decision, for example. Both sides want to get that kind of provision in the trade agreement, which could mean a lot more lawsuits like that. Both sides want to include something we haven't seen before much in trade agreements, what's called regulatory cooperation. So basically establishing a lot of new roadblocks to new rules. Any kind of new rule on, say, food safety or toxic chemicals or what have you would have to go through this whole obstacle course of different cost-benefit analyses and different things that would slow down new rules. So really, you know, while there are particular interests that the U.S. has versus what Europe has, overall this is a corporate agenda, and that's really what's driving the process.
Well, let me just ask you simply, how is this not trading away sovereignty? I have heard the ISDS, that investor state dispute settlement, I've heard that kind of laughed off. I've heard pundits say, oh no, you know, we can still make domestic rules about pollution, for example. Other countries won't be able to overturn our laws. Well, other countries maybe not, but transnational corporations, it sounds like, would, or at least would have standing to do that. Is that not a threat to sovereignty?
Oh, it's absolutely a threat. And, you know, we haven't been hearing as much in the United States about TTIP, the transatlantic deal, in part because there's been so much focus on the TPP. But this is headline news in Europe. There have been massive demonstrations, particularly in Germany, Austria, and France. And a lot of it does focus on this investor state provision. And in Germany, a lot of it was sparked by Germany decided to phase out nuclear power. And so a Swedish firm is suing them for $5 billion. So that is absolutely a threat to their sovereignty, and it's something that has had hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. Just this week, the president of France said, you know, if this is what the agreement is, we can't sign on to this. And the lead negotiator said maybe the talks would be suspended. So it has been big news in Europe. I think we need more of a focus in the U.S. too, but certainly it's absolutely a threat to sovereignty.
How can it, though, be a surprise to global leaders? Are they not aware that this is what these trade deals do? I mean, I don't think it's really a shock. The details, of course, are horrifying in their specifics, but the general thrust of it is not a shock to activists who've been doing this work for years. Why are national leaders, is it a pretense that they are surprised by it? I'm not quite clear what's going on with that.
Well, I would say there's two pieces to that. First of all, they are reacting because there is such a massive public outcry. So they're reacting to what their populations are concerned about. On the other hand, I think since the beginning of these talks, Europe has said, I mean, I've talked to agriculture ministers, for example, in Europe, and they say really consistently, no hormone beef, no chlorine chicken, no GMOs. And they'll say this in public statements. And then 2 weeks later, someone from the U.S. government would say, this is absolutely on the agenda. So it's going back and forth. You know, we are in the process of negotiations. And while a lot of what's in the text is shocking, it's still under negotiation. I don't think they're surprised. I mean, these issues have been on the table since the beginning. I suspect what is a surprise is just the degree of public reaction in Europe.
Well, let's continue with that, because it's somewhat irritating in a way to hear the New York Times say on May 2nd, after decades of free trade orthodoxy, there's been growing resistance to further liberalizing the movement of goods, services, capital, and labor. It sounds as though activism has sprung out of nowhere on this issue, when in fact, even in the United States, we've had decades of work, have we not, of understanding what these corporate-centric trade pacts do and of resisting them.
Oh, absolutely. When this big leak came out, it made me think back to the free trade area of the Americas. Those texts were published. That was going to be a massive free trade agreement in all of the Americas, North and South America, and it was defeated because of activism throughout the hemisphere. Certainly, there have been big fights on each of the trade agreements, and just last summer, the approval process for Fast Track, the process that Congress uses to debate these trade agreements, was hugely controversial. So I think there's more public opposition. We see it more mm-hmm. than perhaps in the last few years. But absolutely, this has been going on for a long time.
Say we hear that the pact actually has been scuttled. Is that the end of the story?
No, certainly not. I mean, of course, there is the other big trade agreement on the horizon, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which could be coming up for a vote sometime this year or perhaps next year. So there's absolutely that. But even if we were to defeat both of them, there are still these issues of corporate control over our food systems, over our economies, and we need to keep pushing for alternatives.
We've been speaking with Karen Hansen-Kuhn of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You can find their work online at iatp.org. Karen Hansen-Kuhn, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
New York tabloids didn't bother with terms like alleged in their stories on the early morning raid in the Bronx, in which law enforcement, local and federal, arrested more than 100 people accused of gang membership. There was no need to observe such niceties in a tale of violent thugs being taken down. The New York Times did use the word accused, but their depiction of the community involved was no less cartoonish. For the last 10 years, the Times told readers, quote, life in the northern Bronx has been largely defined by wanton violence, close quote. One wonders how much the Times knows about what defines life in the northern Bronx and why they and other media are so ready to cheer uncritically for this style of militarized intervention, ostensibly aimed at reducing violence. Josmar Trujillo is a writer and organizer with New Yorkers Against Bratton. His work appears in City Limits, Huffington Post, and other outlets. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Josmar Trujillo.
Hey, Janine. How are you?
Well, first give us a little context. I mean, even though you wouldn't guess it from media, I think some listeners probably have heard that crime is actually declining. So what is your sense of what drove this really outsized show of force? I mean, 700 agents. What's behind that?
Raids, and gang raids in particular, aren't new in New York City or really in the United States. But last Wednesday's raid, the size of it and the media hype around it, they're expanding from the last, I'd say, like 2 to 3 years. And probably even more so since the death of a police officer in my neighborhood in Spanish Harlem last October. A lot of that had to do with the strategy of the district attorney there, Cy Vance. Now, Cy Vance's father was the former Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter. Cy Vance has these really ambitious political aspirations. And so when he came in, I think he wanted to peg himself as like a gangbuster. And if you look around in the city today, we have probably the slowest crime stats in the city's history for like the last 50 years. There's no Lucchese crime family. You know, there's no big-name mobsters or gangsters out there. So how can you become a gangbuster? You find gang members, or maybe in some cases create or hype up what are known as crews, which are these local groupings of young men in public housing that a lot of law enforcement equate to gangs. So Vance in 2014 launched this huge raid in West Harlem where 103 people were indicted, and that had set the city's record up until last Wednesday. Another part of that might have been the arrival of Bill Bratton. He not only has a lot of experience going after gangs in Los Angeles when he was the LAPD chief, but he's also really good at squeezing out as much mileage out of the media in terms of law enforcement. He's kind of renowned for being like a media master,
right,
as much as a police mind. So my best sense is the raids in East Chester Gardens last week, which, again, is, first of all, in the context of a city that is like much, much safer. But even that particular neighborhood, when you look at CompStat reports, again, the police department's own reports, has crime stats for like maybe the last 6, 7, 8 years. Every single year, more safe than the last. And in shootings and murders in particular, which is what the media was hyping up, the last CompStat report we saw was there was 2 shootings year-to-date so far in 2016. So again, not zero, but definitely much lower than highs of New York City at its peak had, a couple of thousand murders a year. My best sense is that the raid itself last week, which included several federal agencies, it's one of the reasons is federal charges are being used against these suspects. So these guys are no longer being tried in state courts. They're being tried in federal courts. But part of that is also just normalizing the role of federal authorities to deal with is basically street crimes, violent street crimes, but still street crimes. And my best sense is the federal agencies are trying to just find a place in crime because there's really not a lot of use for them in a lot of other areas.
Everybody wants a slice.
Everybody come on into the party while it's getting hot because the police department is making it a point. And in December, and with the help of the Daily News, they basically announced that they were going to be doing this and this is going to be the new normal. And part of that is using the media, like the Daily News, to create this idea that there's a gang on every street corner of New York City.
They also had that useful to the reader guide about your own relationship to gangs, right?
Yeah, I think the quote was, how close are they to you? And they had like this interactive map where you could basically, you know, very conveniently, you could, you know, plug in your street address and find out, oh, look, honey, there's a gang nearby.
I know listeners understand that we're not saying that none of the people arrested is guilty of anything. You know, that's a straw man argument we can dispense with. But the New York Times in their story had basically a single community source that wasn't an authority. And that was a woman who said, I'm so glad I would kiss the captain's feet, you know, talking about the raid. Well, you also talked to people in Eastchester Gardens in the wake of this most recent raid. What were some of the thoughts that people were telling you that didn't make it into that Times story?
So the very first person that we spoke to, and we went on there on Wednesday, you know, early evening, 10, 12 hours after the raid, and the first person that we spoke to, she was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm out here with Mike. And she was out there with her two kids and her dog. She was like, I'm out here every night with my kids. I feel pretty safe. I've been living here since I was born. She was 37, so she's been there 37 years. I don't know what they're talking about. If there was any violence, it was probably like 10 years ago, and it's much safer now. She said, as you can see, I'm out here at night with my kids, and the media is playing this up as if this is a place that people were afraid to step out of their front door. So we went and talked to a few other people, and a couple of people didn't want to talk to because some people, you know, are maybe also apprehensive about talking to the media because they think that their words are going to be twisted. We really didn't find anyone who said, who had anything about kissing the captain's feet. I'm sure there's some people there who thought that this was a good idea, but most of the people we talked to, actually every single person we talked to, said the raid was over the top. Some of them differed on whether the violence was big or not big. Again, the shootings and the murders are above zero, so any number above zero, you could say, deserves attention. But one young woman that we spoke to, she was with another young man, she was crying because she knew some of the people who were caught up in the raid. And she said these people didn't have anything to do with it, or if they were involved in anything, low-level drug dealing or anything like that, this was years ago. And many of them had served sentences and were already coming back, were starting to raise families. So to the extent that there was even people who were involved, a lot of them were changing their life around. And the raid kind of threw them on these federal racketeering charges that made it sound like they were, like, you know, John Gotti. And the heartbreaking part of it is a lot of these young people don't have lawyers that John Gotti could afford. They didn't even have the opportunity to speak to a lawyer before they were thrown in front of New York Post and Daily News front pages as gangbangers. This is something that I have to say as just being kind of like a city-based writer. Like, I've gone to places and I've seen reporters for local news organizations talk to people who give completely different accounts of what the narrative is, and they won't run it. Like, I've seen it with my own eyes. There was a shooting a couple of years ago. I went over there, I tried to talk to people, and I saw people being interviewed saying things that were like, no, this is not what's happening, this is what's really happening, and local news coverage just won't run it. They'll wait and they'll look for someone that fits the narrative that they're already going in with, and they'll run that, and they'll run it prominently over and over and over and over. And that's why I think it's important to have alternative media be able to come in and say, like, this is what some other people are saying, to at least create some kind of conversation around it, because it's such a completely self-evident, but if you were to read a Daily News article or a New York Post article or a New York Times article, for that matter.
There's a point at which the conversation about protecting a community becomes really demonizing the community. I mean, how are you helping anybody by declaring that their life is defined by wanton violence? We see neighborhoods turned into problems in themselves. It's not the crime, it's the community that becomes the problem. When you talk to community advocates, they have their own ideas about how to improve things in their community. If, say, the question is gang membership, you know, or violence in public housing, what are some of the things that those community members would point people to that we're maybe not hearing about?
there was a great article in a website called the Juvenile Justice Internet Exchange back in 2014 after the West Harlem raids. And it was actually being written before the raids happened. And the headline said it all. It said, "We asked the city for help, and we got a raid instead." And what people were saying and what that author and a lot of people had been saying for a long time is that to the extent that there was violence, community members wanted to steer youth away from violence to begin with, give them other options in a place where there's virtually no job opportunities, education is crumbling or non-existent. There is a sense amongst a lot of people of color in low-income communities across the city that this just condensation of poverty is at the root of any violence. And again, the violence is being hyped. But to the extent that there is violence, community members wanted an approach that really steered people away and got at root causes, and they were continually ignored over and over. And so what they got instead from the city was a giant raid, because that's what the city understands. That's what the police department understands. And politically, for their own reasons, it was self-serving. They want to show that they're, you know, tough on crime still, you know, even if the crime is a fraction of what it was 20 years ago. And so they place these kids on a basically like a super predator pedestal and frame them in this way. And all of those conversations about after-school programming, community centers that need to be reopened because they've been closed for 5 years in Manhattanville, which is one of the houses in West Harlem, they had a community center closed for 5 years straight. All of those issues just are completely ignored. Poverty, we don't want to hear it. Opportunities, what's that? Like, it's about the gang raid, it's about the gang member this, gang member that, and that's all it ends up being for the people who hear about this in the media, and that's all they'll ever see about it. That's the double slap in the face. On the one side, you get the raid, and on the other side, you get the media painting your entire life as just revolving around violence.
We've been speaking with Josmar Trujillo. You can find his recent piece, NYPD Raids Won't Solve NYCHA's Violence Problem, on the No Backspace blog at citylimits.org, and Gang Raids and Our Addiction to Super Predators on Huffington Post. Josmar Trujillo, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.